This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. This week, we welcome Tess Gerritsen back to the show. She's an internationally acclaimed New York Times bestselling author with over 40 million copies of her books sold worldwide in dozens of languages, including, fortunately, English. She's perhaps best known as the creator of the Rizzoli and Isles series, which inspired the hit television drama. Tess Gerritsen has written more than 30 books, including romance, medical thrillers, intricate crime novels, and historical fiction. Her new book is part of a hit new spy thriller series, The Martini Club, The Shadow Friends. Tess Gerritsen, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
It's good to be back.
Your new book is so entertaining and exciting, and it really has elements of all of those genres that I just mentioned. I mean, it's got crime and medical thriller and romance and espionage. You sort of mixed them all in.
Yeah, well, I think since my characters are now in their 70s, I wanted to show that we still have exciting lives. we can still be tempted into sexual exploits, and adventure never dies.
You have older characters. Is that because you think you have an older audience like me, or?
It's because the author herself has gotten pretty darn old, and I couldn't have written this book 30 years ago. I wouldn't have understood that as you get older, that everything changes. At least the world changes around you. They look at you differently, and that's the main thing that happens, is they look at us as if our lives are over, that we don't have adventures, that we're not like still tempted to have affairs, that we still can't do the things we used to do. And I wanted to show characters who really, that they still have it. They can still be tempted. And they are still able to go on missions that might be dangerous.
Your characters, they live a normal life, but they have a past in which they were espionage agents. And you live a normal life, but you were once a doctor.
And
is there a connection there that is, do you ever feel your past life calling to you? I should get out there and cut somebody open.
No, I don't. I do use that past life as a resource when I'm writing.
Yeah.
I think that the real thrill for me, what drew me was that I live in this little town. I think we might have talked about it last time. I live in this little town of 5,000 people in the state of Maine that seems to be a haven for retired intelligence officers. We have a lot of spies in town, or their children or their families. But we also have State Department here. So it's an interesting enclave, and it just seemed like it was crying out to have a book written about it, or about a fictional version of it.
So that I was talking with the author Anthony Horowitz, who created the television series Midsummer Murders, about all these murders that happened in this little town. And eventually he had to just sort of walk away from that show and let other people do it, because he just thought, well, it's ridiculous that so many murders are happening in this little small town. do you have that issue as you're continuing your series? I mean, how many horrible things can happen in this little town?
Well, it's probably limited. I mean, I'm working on book number 4, and I'm not sure after this what else can happen. I think that with each book, I would like to focus a little bit more on my different characters. The first book was about Maggie Bird and why she left the CIA. The second book was really about the town itself. The town becomes a character, and the conflicts between the locals and the people from away. This book, The Shadow Friends, focuses on Ingrid and her marriage. That's what drew me to it, because I've always wondered, why is Ingrid married to Lloyd? Ingrid was a covert operative. She was a risk taker. She's very clever and quick. And she's married to Lloyd, who was an analyst, is the ultimate beta male, loves to hang out in the kitchen, you know, does all the things that we think of as our wives would do if we had wives. So why was she attracted to him? And what is there about Lloyd that we haven't seen yet? The idea was to put their marriage under a stress, to see the stress test of this marriage and whether it would survive. A pretty interesting blow in the story. Ingrid's past colleague, who was also with the CIA and incidentally was her hot lover, is now back in the picture. He wants her to join him on an operation, and he's still as good looking as ever. So what would Ingrid do? I mean, here she's tempted by this man who clearly wants to get back in bed with her. And she has her beloved husband, and she also has this interesting operation that really she wants to join. So I wanted to see what happens to their marriage, and I wanted to see the hero side of Lloyd come out. So you know that, yeah, he's a beta male, but he will do anything, including risk his life, because he loves this woman.
That's kind of, you know, again, I know we want to avoid all the spoilers. And that's kind of where the romance of your, in your book comes, and then the relationship of these two people. And it's, kind of turns out to be pretty challenging, I think, for Lloyd.
Poor Lloyd.
And it's really fun to picture these people, and you give, you know, you paint a good physical description of them. I'm sort of always casting in my mind of who would play these parts. And you've had that experience of having Rizzoli and Isles drawn from your books. And, you know, those gals were hip hugger wearing, you know, gorgeous young women.
Not my characters.
Yeah. So, right. They weren't exactly the characters you created. But, I mean, I'm sure you'd love to see, and I would love to see the Martini Club as a series. I think it'd make a wonderful kind of, I mean, it's got the kind of the elements of a
series. Yeah. It is in development at Amazon Studios.
Ah.
I know that they hired the writer's room, and I believe they were even talking about moving forward into approaching talent. But then there was a shakeup at the top of the studios. So we're waiting for that to calm down and find out whether it's still a go. But you know, they have their showrunner, and I believe they were looking at maybe 8 episodes, which would cover the first book.
Oh, that'd be so much fun. But now you bring up another topic that I want to ask you about. You know, politics intrude in almost everything that we do. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed, but politics are kind of strange these days. And
I live in Maine, so I really understand.
and I'm sure that, you know, as a writer of fiction, you know, and of course you want your fiction to be timeless, and you want people to read these books in 50 years or 75 years. So you don't want to get, you know, too specific, and also you don't want to alienate any of your readership. But I feel, maybe I'm just reading into it, but I think there's a political element in what you're doing in this particular book, because you talk about, it's set, you know, in our world, in the real world, and you talk about how the intelligence agents are talking about how everything's different now in the intelligence agency world, and you can't necessarily trust the people at the top. And
it's a reflection of our current reality right now. I mean, I follow a lot of intelligence blogs, so I know what people are saying, what they're thinking in Central Intelligence. And, you know, they've let go a lot of people, a lot of seasoned, experienced people that have been with the agency for decades are being pushed aside by people who have no background in intelligence. And people who... they're being replaced by people who are, they have different loyalties. Their loyalties may not lie with the country, but with a particular person or with a particular administration. So there is upheaval going on there as well as other parts of government. And I can't ignore that fact. That's one of the reasons why in this particular book, they turn to an outside private intelligence firm. And that is actually happening, that there are private intelligence firms that are being pulled in for operational things. And I also take into account some of the real politics of our relationship with Russia and with the number of assassinations of Putin's enemies. I mean, probably 50 people have died, mysterious deaths, falling out of windows, being hit with umbrellas, with poison darts, and polonium, which is one of the methods that I discuss quite, you know, quite in detail.
So you did a lot of research into that, obviously.
Yes, I did, especially with the polonium, because I'm a medical doctor, that was what was interesting to me. And how easy it is to miss. Polonium poisoning can look like a severe gastrointestinal illness. In fact, when there was a polonium poisoning in London, it took them weeks to figure out what was really going on. Even though the man himself said, "I was poisoned," they didn't believe him. So I'm sure there are some deaths that are occurring, some assassinations that we're not even aware are assassinations.
Well, the reason I'm asking this question, you just said, you know, you couldn't avoid talking about these things. But of course you could. I mean, you could write a book in which none of these things are factors. But I just talked to an author who wrote a book about baseball. And then I talked to an author who wrote a book, A History of Movies. And both of those books, the baseball book and the movie book, the last chapters were all about Donald Trump and the problems that they have with Donald Trump. And yet they're books about baseball and movies. So, I mean, you must have strong feelings and that you did this deliberately. You're writing about this because you want to get into people's heads about these things.
Well, I do have strong feelings, but the real reason for including it is just that that's our current political situation and it is reflected in intelligence. And also I wanted to bring in the reasons for why we would call on a private intelligence firm to do things that really our CIA should be doing instead. And sometimes you have to reach outside the box to get things done. So it was one of the plot points of the book. So, and you know, my next book, the one I'm working on, is going to take even more into account current events. So,
oh, yeah? Okay. Well, I'm glad. I mean, you know, I think it's important. And I think you're insidiously changing the minds of people who are reading your books.
Well, all I'm doing is opening their eyes and asking them to please read the news and to please find out what our seasoned spies are saying and how many of them are leaving the agency.
How do you think things are going in your state?
Oh, it's been a crazy, crazy couple of months. I know everybody's been following the Plattner implosion.
Yeah.
I think the best way I can round it up is to quote the headline of my hometown newspaper. The headline was, "After long odyssey, Maine Democrats arrive at Troy." Because our candidate is Troy Jackson. But that's essentially what it is. We've had a long odyssey trying to find just the right candidate, and we'll see what happens.
As a writer, how do you feel about the fact that suddenly the most important thing in the world is this, the odyssey? I mean, it's a piece of literature that people are really focused on. Is that gratifying that people are thinking about reading in libraries and books?
I think it's great, although there have been so many versions of the Odyssey and the Iliad too. And I know that, you know, Christopher Nolan's getting some flack for his particular interpretation, but you know, it's his interpretation and it's as valid as any other modern interpretation. So I think it's wonderful that people are going back to the myth. I mean, my granddaughter is 12 and she had read the Odyssey.
Mm.
So she went into the movie fully focused on, you know, what did she read and how was it going to compare? And she came away just blown away just by the movie.
I read the Classics Illustrated version. It was great.
Yeah. I mean, we've all read the our little mythology books from childhood. We know kind of what happened, and some of us know him as Ulysses, and some of us know him as Odysseus. And
you know, I was thinking of Tess Gerritsen. She's written 30 plus books. Have I even read that many books? No. Yeah. I've been reading a lot of John D. MacDonald lately. I really enjoy his work, and I was wondering, are there any classic adventure, crime fiction or whatever writers that you enjoy, or are you too busy writing to really read that stuff?
I am too busy to read most of the stuff. I mean, if you talk about classics, I mean, if you go back to Conan Doyle or, you know, Agatha Christie, sure. I mean, those are from my childhood. And recently I've gotten onto the Mrs. Polifax.
Oh, yeah, those are great.
Yeah. I mean, it's when I go back and look at that, it's especially the very first one of Mrs. Polifax, where she's just a retired lady who's depressed and thinking about taking her life. So what does she decide to do? She decides to volunteer to be a CIA agent. And it sounds ridiculous, but it turns into quite an adventure. It's a fun series.
Well, I was thinking about that when I was reading, as I read the Martini Club stories. You know, they had a kind of a patina of cozy crime story. They're set in Maine and these old people in there. But, you know, but then, you know, then they peel off somebody's face. So how do you sort of juggle the elements of your book? Because you always have, I mean, you've written horror and you've written stuff like that too. So there's always a kind of a graphic, violent nature to some of the stories that you write.
Yeah, I try to avoid graphic violence. But in this, with these five people, or four of them anyway, the ones who were covert operatives, they are genteel on the surface, but they have seen and done some things that we really would not want to experience. And every so often that comes out. And when that comes out, I think there's a scene in The Shadow Friends where they've ambushed somebody. And the question is, are they going to be nice, genteel people and take him to the cops, or are they going to try and waterboard him? And so I think that choice of what do we do now is kind of funny.
Well, I'm also interested, you know, you were mentioning that they're in their 70s, and I have no idea what that's like because I'm 28. but in fact, every time I turn around, I've got some kind of a bruise. Where did this come from? And like I've stubbed my toes, all kinds of things that didn't used to ever bother me. So I'm thinking about them running around fighting crime, I guess we'd say. And how much research have you done into the physicality of what you ask your characters to do?
Well, I haven't asked them to do crazy things. I mean, they don't jump out of airplanes anymore. And they do. I mean, in the first book, after they've been on an overnight flight and walked around Bangkok for a while, they all go in for their afternoon naps. So they, you know, they take into account their physicality. What their best talents are really just experience and knowledge and a way of looking around corners, looking at the patterns and figuring out how these things all fit together. That's experience talking, and you don't need to run for that.
That's true. Oh, Chris, there is some tackling, but we're talking with best-selling author Tess Gerritsen, and her new thriller is The Shadow Friends. It's a really good one. How does your medical background influence the way you structure a narrative? I mean, do you approach plotting a thriller the way a doctor would approach a diagnosis?
No, not at all. I think there's a real difference in being a doctor and being a writer. I mean, doctors, they have a system. they know what they're looking for, and they're eliminating things. As a writer, I'm really going purely on emotions. What would happen next? What would excite me now? Oh my God, what would, you know, will she choose him or will she not choose him? So it's very much a subjective thing. Whereas as a medical doctor, you're trying to be objective and follow logic. Characters are not logical. They will do crazy things just like real human beings will. So it's a very, very different part of your brain that you're using. But where I do use my medicine is sometimes it directs where the plot is going. Like, for instance, when I first wrote my very first draft of The Spy Coast, my question was whether her future husband would be a professional chef or whether he would be a doctor. Of course, I chose doctor because I know that world. And it opened up a lot of possibilities that I'm comfortable with, that I'm familiar with. In The Shadow Friends, I chose to have the assassination be by polonium because it would require hospital scenes, and I'm comfortable with those. and I'm comfortable with, you know, what are the symptoms and what's the treatment. So it does, to a certain extent, determine where my plot is going.
Do you know exactly where your plot is going when you sit down to write, or do your characters surprise you?
Now, I don't know. I have no idea where they're going. I mean, as I'm trying to figure out my way through book number four, it ended up in a place I was never expecting. So sometimes you just write yourself into a corner and you think, okay, I'm going to open that window and that's the direction I'm headed in. And it'll take you in unexpected ways.
So while you're telling us a story, you're telling yourself the same story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to go back and change things all the time because that window opened up to a dead end. So, you know, I get writer's block all the time, and I'm sure most of your guests and you too come to a point in a story, in a manuscript, where you think, I have no idea what happens next. I don't know how to explain everything crazy that's happened. I need to walk away. And I walk away for a couple of weeks and figure it out.
And do you work on something else?
No, I brood. I brood. I'm very unpleasant. You know, I sit and I glower and I lie on the couch and look at the ceiling and I take long walks or I take long drives. But eventually the brain figures it out. There's like that aha moment and it all becomes clear.
Well, not my brain, but your brain, the brain of Tess Gerritsen, which when you're done with, I would like to have it. yeah, no, I have permanent writer's block, so. I've never written anything, but I want to know about the characters. Do you have there's five members of your? It was really six, including Joe, right? In your stories, mm-hmm. Joe is the younger. She's sort of us. We're the ones, right? She represents us. We're watching.
She represents those of us who have no idea what's ever going on.
Yeah. So do you have biographies? Did you sort of sit down and write biographies of them? Are there things about them that or do you or you write it as you go? Oh, you know what they could do?
I never write biographies. I find that if you know everything at the beginning, it's really boring to write the story. I like the process of discovery. When I start off with a character, I will generally know their gender, not always. I'll know their age. I will know their educational background because I can hear their voices. I know what their vocabulary is. But most of all, what I know about my characters from the very start is where are they starting emotionally? What, are they sad? Are they happy? Are they self-satisfied? And the whole series began because I could hear Maggie Bird's voice speaking to me, and I could hear that she was haunted, that something had gone wrong. And I wanted to find out what that thing was. And that was the whole basis for the first book, was what went so badly wrong that Maggie had to leave the CIA and is still troubled by what she did or the results of her last operation.
And this book, the Shadow Friends, starts back in the day, I guess is the precise way of putting it, with some traumatic event that haunts our characters now.
Yeah, we start off with a look back at Ingrid's years as undercover, and she's trying to protect a young woman who's an informer, and it all goes wrong, and she loses two colleagues in the most gruesome of ways. And so now it's years later, and echoes of that past assassination come back into her life, and that's what pulls her back into this relationship with her ex-lover. It starts off with the first scene not only sets up the plot, but what I really wanted to do with that first scene is show that she was torn between this the man she was having an affair with and the man she eventually marries. So why does she choose Lloyd? And you get a look at her decision-making process at that point. Was she's leaving this exciting lover, she's going back, and she's going to marry the man who's, you know, he'll have a TV dinner at night, he'll cook for her, they'll watch videos together. They don't do exciting things, but she can rely on him, and that's the choice she makes.
And I'm, you know, we're all happy that she does because we have our
kids. Yeah, we're happy.
So, you know, you've written, so this is the third book in the series, and you're writing another one. And not only as during our conversation, we want to avoid spoilers, but when you're writing your books, you reference events that happen in earlier books, but you're careful not to spoil those books because you don't know where people are when they.
Yeah.
They might be picking up your book. It's the first time they've ever read a Tess Gerritsen, so you don't want to. You want them to read them all.
That is the challenge with writing a series. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you do that? Is it an eggshell kind of approach to it?
I want to give them enough backstory so they understand the characters, but I don't want to be specific about the past plots. So what you're really trying to do is just introduce them to why they are here at this point in their lives. So that's why you know where Maggie is. We know Maggie and Declan are now an item. You know, she's eventually realized that her best friend is also going to be her lover. So, I can't tell you how they get to this point because that's the whole point of the first book. But I think that by the time I finish book number four, everybody should pretty much know what they need to know about these five characters.
Now, you were saying that, you know, you're not sure if the Martini Club has a fifth story or not, but I mean, do you have, are you looking ahead? Can you always see? Do you have like 100 stories rattling in your head? I've got to write this one.
Yeah, no, right now I'm still focused on book number four and the intricacies of getting this plot together. I haven't come up with a fifth book. Mm-hmm. So we shall see. I mean, right now I'm distracted by other things. I mean, I'm working with Lifetime to develop a wheel of movies.
Oh, uh-huh.
So I'm doing some screenwriting as well. And they've already filmed the first movie. So we have to continue on writing the next couple of scripts.
And what movie is it? What's it? Tell us about it.
Right now, the tentative title is Murder in a Cold Place. And
set in Iceland.
I love stories that center around a fish out of water. People who are places where everything feels weird to them. And the idea is that there's a Miami homicide detective, a woman, who goes through a very traumatic experience and leaves Miami and goes as far as she can get, and she ends up in Anchorage, Alaska. Uh-huh. And there she gets paired up with another female cop, and it's a little bit like Rizzoli and Isles, but these two hate each other. And the fun part is seeing the woman from Anchorage who's born and bred in Alaska dealing with this cop from Miami, and you know there's such a culture gap there. So that was the first movie, and then they wanted three more that have to do with the same characters.
Well, that sounds like it'll be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to seeing it. How does writing a screenplay, I mean, I know you spend a lot of time, because I read your books, on the physical appearance and so on of people, but you don't have to do when it's a screenplay. How does writing a screenplay, how does writing a screenplay differ for you as a writer?
You know, it is different. It's fun. It's snappy. You don't have to deal with descriptions. I mean, a sentence or two can get you into your setting. It's really all about character and dialogue. And that's the part that's, I think, the most fun, when you are doing the writing. You don't have to worry about atmosphere because the atmosphere can be described, very quickly. So that's the difference. But I think that what I now have to pay attention to, which I never had to pay attention to as a novelist is budget.
Oh, right.
So scene you write, you don't want to burn down houses. You don't want car crashes because that is just going to make it too expensive. So you really focus on, thrills that have to do with plot points and dialogue.
And now that you've done the first film and you know who the actors are, what they look like and what they're capable of, do you find mm-hmm. yourself thinking about them, writing for them?
You have to, it has to stay within what you've already seen on screen. And you also, because it's a continuing characters, you have to make sure that, what we call the A story is that each movie has its own mystery that has to be solved by the end. But then there's always the B thread that goes through it, which is the development of their relationship that will go on to movie three and movie four.
Yeah. An arc, I guess, right?
Yeah, the character arc. Yeah, that's going to be the B story.
And is that fun?
It is fun. I think the difficulty, though, is that you're also dealing with a group of people. So there are, there's a director, there's a producer. I have a co-writer, and he's like he and I are like perfectly matched because he used to be a stand-up comic. So whenever I'd get to a point, I need a funny line here. Give me a funny line. You know, he always has one. So it's been a real fun partnership.
You have to give up a certain level of control though, right? I mean, you may not be happy with the final product or whatever.
Yeah, that's the downside of writing for a production company is that you are not, you know, as a novelist, you're the master of your universe. And now you're like one little part of it. You're, you know, like Mount Olympus. Maybe you're not Zeus, but you're Aphrodite or something, and you have a voice, but it's not necessarily going to be the rule of law.
Do you enjoy collaborating as much as working alone in your typewriter?
There are pluses and minuses in both ways. I mean, sometimes it's frustrating, but other times it's fun, especially when somebody else throws in a line. You think, oh, that's a genius line. Let's use it.
Do you write on a computer or on a legal pad, or how do you do your writing?
Well, that's really funny because when I write my scripts, I'm doing it on a computer. I'm able to do it. When I'm writing my novels, I have to use pen and paper. I still do.
That's interesting. And do you employ, now that you're so successful with 1 million books in print, I mean 400 million, I can't forget what the number was, but do you have a staff that works for you?
No, I do. I have a very good friend who answers my public email. Unfortunately, most of that now is spam.
Right.
I mean, every writer in the world is getting hit with, I've read your book and I would love to be, you know, for a fee, I will do this and this. So unfortunately, that's what
I get that on my website all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the only person I do employ and then I have a literary agent, of course.
Right. But you are the one who transcribes your writing into.
Yeah. Nobody can read my handwriting.
What about you? I mean, do you ever say, what did I write there? Can you always?
Well, sometimes I can't read my handwriting.
Because you're a doctor. That's like a famous thing. Yeah. Doctors can't read terrible handwriting.
That's right. Doctors have a lot of, we have a lot of, you know, little codes we write to ourselves. So we know what that little symbol means. It's a whole word, but nobody else would know it.
Oh, it's just a shorthand. Yeah. I know we've talked about this before, but I'm just interested in when you were a doctor, were you also a writer? And then,
I used to write when I was an intern. You know, you'd be on call and you'd have like, they give you like a little room to take naps in. I'd be there writing.
And were you thinking, you know, someday I'll be able to give up this stethoscope and write?
No, for me, it was always a hobby. I never imagined that it would become as much of a career as it has. I wanted to be a writer since when I was 7 years old. So it's been a lifelong need to be a storyteller. But I think that even as a doctor, I always assumed I would continue to be a doctor and that writing would just be my side gig.
Yeah, but that didn't happen.
No, after the books took off, especially after Harvest, when that hit the bestseller list, I realized that I could make a living at it. And that's where I went.
So your new book is called The Shadow Friends. It's volume 3 in your Martini Club series, and I'm so glad you wrote it, and I loved reading it, and I love talking to you. Thank you for hanging out with us and talking about it.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf. Monty Roberts died in August of 2026 at the age of 91. He was an extraordinary equestrian, a Hollywood stuntman, and a best-selling author whose humane, nonviolent methods of horse training influenced several generations of equestrian professionals. I had the opportunity to speak with him back in 2005. Today, we listen back to that interview with the man who could talk to horses, Monty Roberts. Monty Roberts, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be on with you.
In your newest book, you discuss horses more as respected colleagues than as livestock. Just how smart are horses? How much do they understand about what they do in the human world?
Well, horses are flight animals, and as flight animals, they can only have two goals in life. One is to survive, and the other to reproduce. And since we don't deal with reproduction where horses are concerned, it's only survival. But in that mode and in that narrow channel, they are extremely intelligent. It's fixed and it's limited. Their dictionary isn't very thick, but they are brilliant where they know what they're doing.
And can that be a disadvantage? I mean, are there times when you expect more from a horse than they can deliver?
Well, there's times when I think most people do expect more from a horse than they can deliver. They also, I think, juxtapose that a horse can plan, connive, can fake things. Horses cannot lie, and they can only deal with the item of the moment. They can't do any planning. They're not evil. They don't come after any other species. They will only act to survive.
Now, you're saying you don't think horses do a little bit of play acting once in a while, like when they have an injured leg and then, you know, they forget to limp and then they see you're looking at them and then they limp again?
Doesn't happen.
Okay.
Doesn't happen.
It's just us anthropomorphizing.
It is, and it's glamorous, and you can make stories out of it, but that doesn't happen.
Now, you tell a marvelous story in your book about this extraordinary no-name Mustang.
Yeah.
And you were just a boy when you tried your revolutionary training ideas out on that wild horse. Your friends thought it was some kind of illusion, a trick that you played on them.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, now your ideas seem to be more widely accepted, and the training industry has several ideas that relate to your join-up philosophy. You know, what part have you played in the rise of natural horsemanship movement, and how do you see that?
Gary, the world is really changing, and that no-name Mustang, he was the beginning of it all. You know that happened in Salinas, California, and Salinas is halfway between your stations. And so my home was between Santa Cruz and San Ardo. And it was right there in Salinas that this no-name Mustang showed me that there could be interspecies communication and that he could understand the gestures of my anatomy and I could understand the gestures of his, and that collectively we could put these gestures to work, one and the other, and cause information to be transferred from one being to another, in my case a human being, and in his case equus. That started it all. And I just finished a tour in England with 9 cities, and more than 10,000 people got to see me doing demonstrations. And I'll ask you if I'm playing a role in changing it. There will be at least 300,000 horses started in the next 12 months using my methods.
Do you see join up as a thing that will affect, you know, horsemen all over the world then?
Absolutely, I do. It will affect most of the horsemen in the world before my death, if I'm just given a few more years. But I think the fact that I'm producing instructors and setting up schools all over the world, it'll go on long after I'm gone.
Yeah. Now, what about all the movements in natural horsemanship other than join-up specifically? What do you think of the various ones and the various trainers out there and so on?
Well, look, Gary, I'm a fan of anyone who advocates for working with animals in the absence of violence. And I don't care who they are, what their name is, or what they call their body of work. I'm a fan of theirs. And I just ask you to be quite careful, because there's a lot of people that say they work nonviolent, and then they come out with some kind of a whip or other that they've named, and they use violent tactics. And so I would ask you to be careful, to be sure that the person is using nonviolent techniques. And I mean, there's some great ones. Richard Schrake is an absolute star. He's doing super work, and Gowani Pony Boy is doing good work, and there's a lot of people that are expressing themselves in some tremendous changes for this world. I knew Pat Pirelli when he was a child, and he's doing good work. There's some differences I have with Pat's work, but on balance, I'm a fan of his.
Yeah. Well, when you say nonviolent, you know, at what point does it become violence? Are spurs violent? Is a crop violent? Is a bit violent?
There has never been a spur that was violent ever in the history of the world. There's never been a crop that was violent ever in the history of the world. It's only the hands or the feet that hold them. And the way that you use it, if it is to cause pain, to alter the behavioral pattern of the animal you're working with, it's violent.
I see.
And I believe the same is true child to child or parent to child.
Well, you do touch on that in both your new book and your first book about your relationship with your father. How do you think that influenced you as a horse trainer?
Oh, I think it influenced me greatly. I think that my 47 foster children were to level the playing field and to try to cause a better life for kids that that I didn't have. You know, I didn't have a childhood. I was an adult when I was about 6 years of age and in the show ring and doing adult things, and I never shook hands with my father. I never had my father give me a hug or tell me that he loved me, or certainly not that. So I didn't have a childhood, and I had 47 foster children to try to bring, you know, a more civil understanding between parent and child. And they were a university for me, and I'm working with schools all over the world now, and I'm changing the educational patterns of grammar schools everywhere.
Well, you know, I don't know if you know this, but I'm a middle school teacher. I teach 8th grade social studies in Salinas.
Wonderful.
And there are times when I look at my classroom and I see them in the same way that I see a horse, in that if you want your horse to get into the trailer and he weighs 1,200 pounds and he doesn't want to get in the trailer, there's not much you can do about it.
I'm liking this interview a lot. You understand far more than you let me know in the beginning. And it's wonderful to hear things like that, because if it comes down to a fight between a human being and a horse, there is no contest at all, you know? And I do loading demonstrations all over the world, approximately 200 a year, where horses that won't load for 2 or 3 years often are ridden to my demonstration venue. And I load them in an average of about 30 seconds after I work with them for about 8 minutes to get some trust. It's a trust issue.
You can gain the trust of a horse in 8 minutes.
Well, I am doing it.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. You do a clinic, and you work this miracle on Old Wildfire in the ring today.
Yeah.
What about tomorrow? How do you train the owner so that, you know, because they're going to think now, tomorrow morning, Old Wildfire is going to be great.
Gary, it doesn't work when they go home if they go back doing it the same way they did before. And if they don't learn what my techniques are, if they don't learn the language equus, it won't be any good to them at all. And I tell them that going in, and I plead with them to somehow learn. Get the book, get videotapes, come to a course, whatever you have to do, but learn how to communicate with horses before you say, well, I just went back and it wouldn't work. Well, of course it won't work if you just go back and start doing it exactly as you did before.
I see. Oh, by the way, we're talking with Monty Roberts, whose newest book is Horses in My Life. You rode a lot of horses in the movies.
I was in a lot of films, yeah.
And what are some of the great moments in cinema that feature Monty Roberts?
I was an extra. I was a stunt person. I was a child stunt person. And there were a lot of things, stories I could tell you, but I was never glamorous or famous. James Dean lived with me, and I got him ready for East of Eden, and then I was with him at Rebel, and also in the last one,
Giant.
Mm-hmm. I worked with the horses and had to set up scenes and stuff like that. But I mean, I doubled for Roddy McDowell a lot, did stunts for him. And had my pants drug off in one scene. That was kind of a funny one when there were women all around and everything. I was about 7 or 8 years old, and I jumped horses across a field in Northern California with a wig on and a little cap on, and I was supposed to be Liz Taylor in National Velvet.
National Velvet, wow.
Yeah, and things like that. But it was far more work and danger than it was glamour.
Oh, I can imagine it must be pretty dangerous. How many broken bones do you have?
Well, Gary, funny you should ask me that. I have 71 broken bones.
My gosh.
And everyone broken before I was 12, according to the doctors. And I didn't know they were broken until they developed the MRI and the CAT scan. And that I didn't know until 1981. And each of those bones was broken before the age of puberty, because after the onset of testosterone, bones tend to heal in a slightly different way. It's also true that throughout my adult life, I've been in competition every week, 12 months out of the year. And if I had all of these broken bones as an adult, there would have had to have been recesses where I had to go and heal. They happened as a child, and they never happened from horses. They happened from a father that demanded that I step in every track that he laid.
Wow. So never any serious accidents on a horse?
No. I had some accidents. I got kicked in the chin once, and they had to take some stitches in it. I had a horse a couple of years ago break my thumb kicking it in a demonstration in Germany, but I went on and did three more horses that night, and then they x-rayed it and found it was broken and strapped a strap on it. It wasn't a big deal. No, I've had no life-threatening or serious injuries from horses at all.
In your marvelous new book, which is called, let's get the title right, The Horses in My Life.
Right.
You know, there's a certain, you know, anytime we talk about animals, we know that unless we have a Galapagos tortoise or a parrot or something, they're going to go before us. There's a certain sadness to
right.
to that. And oh gosh, it's tragic about your very first horse.
Yeah.
Was killed for meat.
Yeah.
It must have been difficult. So how do you go on? I know when I lost my little dog a couple of years ago, it was like losing a child. This must have happened to you many times in the years that you've been with
us. It did happen to me many times, and burying Brownie and Johnny Tivio were low spots in my life that just, you know, I mean, they just take the soul out of you. You just, you have to pine, but I guess just like with people, you stop and think, I know Johnny Tivio wanted me to go on and do well and try to put to work everything that he taught me with his career. And that if I just sat down and cried the whole time, no horses would benefit from my work. So I took encouragement from how he treated me while he was alive, and made sure that I did better for the horses that I worked with after he was gone.
It's in your book, you have this beautiful picture of your necklace of all of the horses. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yes, I can. All of the indigenous people of the world tended to make their life known to others by a necklace. And they would carve bones or stones in certain ways to depict what happened to them in their life. And they would tell a story of it. The Africans did it. The Mongolian people did it. Certainly the Eskimos carved the walrus tusks, and our American Indians often use turquoise. And so I decided to make a necklace of turquoise stones, 52 of them, depicting the 52 horses that are in this book. And I'll have it with me at the bookstore when I come to see you in a few days. I think I'm coming to...
Yes, you're going to be at the Capitola Book Cafe this Thursday at 7:30.
Okay. I just got in very shortly, just a couple of hours ago, from Baltimore, and I've been gone since the end of August, Germany and England and Canada, and I'm in California to do some book signings for the publishers, who have really shown me a lot of fortitude, because they've done this book in a beautiful way, and they've made a gorgeous book of it with high quality paper and everything, and it is a tribute to the horses that I had teach me. They were my professors, they were my providers, and they protected me, or the early ones did, from my father, because the more I could learn about how to compete, then the more time that I spent in front of audiences, and when I was in front of audiences, I wasn't beaten. So I wanted to be in front of audiences. I wanted to win, and I won championship after championship, right out of Salinas till I was 21, and then San Luis Obispo through Cal Poly, and now I've made a home for now 40 years in Solvang, just south of you and just a bit north of Santa Barbara.
Right. You know, we always stop there to get the pastry.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me ask you, you know, you're famous for your work with horses, and yet now you've become a writer, and not just, you know, any writer, but your books are really good. How did you become such a great writer?
I don't know. You know, I didn't think... my wife helped me get through English classes and stuff when I was in school, and we were in grammar school together in Salinas and Salinas Union High School, and then I went off to Cal Poly for a year, and then we were married, and then she helped me get through Cal Poly too. So I don't know, but the Queen of England encouraged me to write my first book, and she demanded that first book. And I don't think my writing was very good at all in those early manuscripts, and she didn't think it was very good either. So she told me that I should get a tape recorder, and that I shouldn't write, I should just tell the story and keep it conversational. And she said things to me like, tell it like you're telling it to a young boy or a young girl, and just tell us the story of your life. And then we would type it up, and then Pat and I would have hire people to read it to us. And if it didn't sound as though it was a story, if there was a time when it sounded like it was being read from a book, we changed it until it was a story. And now I can do it better. So this last book was a lot of fun and much easier for me to do than the first four books that I did. But this book was about the horses in my life, and that made it very easy, because telling those stories was like sending a kid to a candy shop. You know, it was a lot of fun.
Well, they do feel like they're stories that you've told over the years, but have you kept a journal in your life?
Or? I have kept a journal. I have stacks of writings all the way back to about 12 years of age, and I also have a good memory. Some people say a superior memory, because they'll go back and find that it's true. I have some family members that say I remember things wrong, but you know, we all have ways of remembering our experiences that are slightly different one to the other. But I really have a pretty good handle on what my life was all about.
That reminds me of the first question that I asked you. Monty Roberts, my guest tonight on From the Bookshelf. Mr. Roberts, how well do horses remember? Have you had the experience of not seeing a horse for many years and having the horse remember you or
oh,
not?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as a child, I heard about elephants having such a memory. And the reason that elephants got the reputation for having a good memory was because of the mahouts, the Indian and Pakistani people that worked with elephants a lot. They could test their memory. There was a barometer as to what they remembered in the work that they did. And so an elephant living a long time could be gone from some certain place for, you know, years, and then come back and remember exactly what he did before and do it without any brush-ups at all. And I'm telling you that horses, while they may not have as good a memory as an elephant, I don't know because I don't work with elephants, they have a phenomenal memory. And I've gotten horses back here 14, 15 years of age that had a race career and maybe were owned by 7 or 8 different people. And 30 seconds after I've taken them to the round pen, they remember everything that I taught them when they were a yearling.
Wow.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It really... it's mind-boggling, the memory that they have.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people, I'm certainly not one of them, but there are a lot of people who think horses are just stupid, that they're not capable of recognizing a person.
Well, no, I tend to agree with that. They recognize movement, and they recognize action, things we do. But to remember a person, they're not so good at. That's not what they remember. They remember what happens. They hearken to incidents. They don't have a glamorous sort of romantic memory of human beings, like a dog does, for instance. I agree with that. But by the same token, the actions they remember, and if you come up to them in the same way that someone did that brutalized them, they will go into a survival mode immediately and tend to want to fight you off, fight their way out of a corner, if you will. So they have a fantastic memory.
Have you ever encountered a horse that joining up with is just not possible?
Nope.
So it's possible every time.
Yes, but not. But you know, if you stop and think about that, I am using their language. And if it's their language, even if I did find one, I would have to look inward to see what I did wrong. It's their language. So you can't find a horse that doesn't understand their own language. Now, if you have a horse that was born and its mother died and it became orphaned and it was raised by people, in the kitchen or something, they won't have the innate tendencies that a horse does. And those things instinctual will have slipped away from them. So oftentimes those horses are not as easy to deal with because they don't have the powers that horses have. But if they have a chance to be taught and to hearken to those innate tendencies that horses have developed to be instinctual over 40 to 50 million years, then you're on solid ground, and when you use the language equus, it can't go wrong.
Now, your first book was The Man Who Listens to Horses.
Yep.
And you have your new book, but you have several other books also.
I do. That first one was on the New York Times bestseller list for 58 weeks, and it sold over 5.3 million copies. The second one is called Shy Boy, and that's about a little Mustang. And that one was a bestseller in, I think, 14 or 15 different countries. And it's sold, around 2.5 million books. The third one is Horse Sense for People. And that's the book about how my concepts work with people. And that's what's going on right now in places like Kingshurst Junior School in Birmingham, inner city England, where it was a failing school to be torn down. And in the year 2000, they put my concepts to work there. And in 2004, September, it was declared a center of excellence, and it sits that way now, and there are schools coming at me from everywhere. I've just taken on the Conocti School District in Clear Lake, Lake County, California, and we're going to put my concepts to work there and see if we can help that one out. It's a failing school district. The whole district is failing. Also, Palm Island in Australia, north coast of Australia, last wild enclave of the Aboriginal people. There's a failing school system,
well,
I guarantee you.
I'm a teacher, and people ask me all the time, especially now, you know, what are we doing wrong?
Yeah.
Well, what are we doing wrong?
Well, what we're doing wrong is trying to, A, throw money at the problem, and the more money we spend, the more we expect. And money never bought an education, in my opinion, at all. People have to be paid, and it is fair that we have to have good school systems. But this business of saying you got to teach them, and these kids got to learn, you know, you got to tell them they've got to learn. I mean, you don't teach people anything that way. In fact, I don't believe that teaching exists. I don't think that it exists at all. I think only learning exists, and that the act of teaching implies that you push the information into a brain. And I think the brain of the student must pull the information in willingly. So I turn kids loose. I turn them loose to make mistakes, and we have contracts with them, written contracts, 5 years old written contracts. And they, when they succeed, they get positive consequences for positive actions. And when they are in trouble, they get negative consequences for negative actions. Simple as that. Let them, and you get out of the punishment business totally. And you let them work out their own contracts. You can't believe how well it's working in this Kingshurst Junior School. The kids work out their own contracts. They have their own judge and jury system. They run their own show. Now, naturally, the students are guided and kept together by the teachers and provided the information that they need to learn by the teachers. But the teachers are privileged to go to the school of those children. It's not the teacher's school, it's the children's school, and the teacher's there to facilitate education, not to hammer it into their brains.
What's the difference between negative consequences and punishment?
The difference is that they agree beforehand and sign the paper, and you step back and say, oops, you did that, and you said you would do this if you did that, so get to work. And the work might be drudgery, you know, it might be cleaning the tiles in the toilet or something like that. And whatever you arrive at bilaterally in the beginning is acceptable. And you let the child also agree. And they'll be tougher on themselves than the teachers are on them. And then you have the positive consequences where you spend time with the child doing something that the child likes. And I recommend this for parents too in the families, the immediate families of children. It works really well. So it is very different from punishment. It's their own attempt to get better and to form a better life for themselves. And then when the child, the first question you'll ask is, what if the child just says, I'm not doing that? Well, then there are no privileges whatsoever, but this is bilaterally agreed upon before. There are no privileges whatsoever. They're breaking their own rules, so they can't have anything positive in their life so long as they don't work off the negatives.
So this has to be not just teachers and principal, but everybody, parents and the entire community buying into your program.
Certainly that would be better.
Well, this is very interesting, but I also want to ask, what's next? You have another book coming at some point? Are you thinking about your next book?
Yeah, I am, but Gary, when a guy's 70 years old, you don't ask him what's next.
70, that's nothing.
Okay, but I've formed a nonprofit foundation, and I'm having more fun than I ever had in my whole life, and I'm working on a book right now with the sixth grade teacher at Kingshurst Junior School in Birmingham, England. We're working on a book together that will chronicle the four-year experience with Kingshurst. I'm also being asked by the publishers to do a child's book whereby Shy Boy, the Mustang, actually writes the book, and it's translated by me.
Oh, that's fantastic.
His thoughts for the children as I can best read his thoughts. His thoughts about what went on from wilderness to civilization.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.